Okay, we are moving to the second session, discussion session, which is we're going to address four different questions that relate to certain of the specific essential criteria that are included in the proposed policy statement and some of the comments that we received on those particular criteria. The first question, I'm going to turn to Paul George from the United Kingdom and then Professor Schruff from KPMG, and then open the floor to the other panelists. So let me begin. Question one is, Rule 4012 provides the framework for the board to determine the degree to which it may rely on a non-U.S. inspection. As part of reaching a determination for full reliance under Rule 4012, in the proposed policy statement, the board states that it would require its staff gain a thorough understanding, including through working with the non-U.S. entity staff through joint inspections, before recommending that the board place full reliance on any particular non-U.S. oversight system. And so I know we've been talking about joint inspections now for a good part of the first session. And this question relates to how should the board become comfortable with another system, and in particular, should the board conduct joint inspections as a part of its assessment of the eligibility of that system for full reliance? And if so, what should the parameters for joint inspections be? In other words, should there be a set minimum length of time, or how should the board go about considering that? Paul?
Thank you. Perhaps before addressing the specific question I'm asked to address, just perhaps emphasize a point which has come up earlier in terms of comment letters. And I just want to emphasize that my reading of the comment letters was not that they were an attempt to dilute any of the criteria. I think the comment letters were very supportive of the principles-based approach, but were just encouraging the PCOB to exercise their judgment on how those essential criteria have been met, recognizing that we're not trying to establish identical systems, we're trying to establish effective systems which meet common objectives. Certainly, it has always been my belief that principles are far harder to achieve if you really believe in the principle than it is to achieve some detailed rules. And so I think the comment letters were encouraging a judgment to be applied rather than a tick box approach. Turning perhaps to the question, it's clearly, in my view, appropriate that the board should assess the effectiveness of a non-US regulator before they placed any reliance upon it. Clearly, it's what we would expect an audit firm to do when we inspect an audit firm if they're going to place reliance on internal audit. We wouldn't expect an auditor to place reliance on it, the work of the internal audit function, unless they'd assess their capability to undertake that work in an effective manner. So I think it's quite clear that an assessment has to take place. I think the question is how best to achieve that assessment, and I'm sure there are a number of different ways that can be done, and I think joint inspections is one way, and possibly a very effective way of achieving that. I think the comments I'm going to make on joint inspections that follow are specifically in terms of the use of joint inspections as a tool for assessing the effectiveness of a non-US regulator. It's not about the use of joint inspections as an ongoing tool available to the PCOB in situations where a non-US regulator does not yet meet the level of development to achieve full reliance. So I can see there's an ongoing role there. I think in terms of using joint inspections, and certainly in the UK, this was the approach that we agreed with the PCOB. Certainly the UK legislative framework at the time allowed for cooperation in this way so that proper assessment could be made. And we, from the outset, always saw this as a stepping stone to full reliance. I think that in actually setting about this approach, it's very important that the local regulator leads the process. I think if it's a joint inspection, for an assessment purposes to have the PCAOB take too significant a role in the inspection, then it is not an assessment exercise. It is an exercise of sharing the workload. And I think we need to understand there is a difference between the two. I also believe it should not be an open-ended arrangement, because again, if it wasn't for a finite period, then I think it is really joint inspection as a different tool rather than an assessment tool. But I don't think you could set what that period might be, because I think it depends on what is found in the particular circumstances. In some situations, it's likely that the PCAOB may be able to reach their conclusions of the effectiveness on the system very quickly. In others, it may require a number of joint activities before the required level of comfort is obtained. Certainly, in our experience in the UK, and we've had 5 joint inspections, and I think it's fair to say we started at one of the smaller firms, and the fifth one was probably at one of the largest firms, if not the largest firms. And I expect in comparative or relative terms, the amount of work involved in the first inspection compared to the final inspection were just not comparable in terms of, with each visit, the level of involvement of the PCAOB was reduced as they got more familiar with what we did and developed more comfort in what we're actually doing. So I think it worked as a useful tool there. I'm now firmly, as the PCAOB will know, and also from my comments in response to the proposed policy statement, believe that having gone through that process, having undertaken 5 inspections, not found any situations where we were reaching different conclusions, having had no questions from the PCAOB on the effectiveness of our system, I believe that we are now very ready to move to full reliance, and that's what I would expect to do. And I would believe that's the right approach for others if joint inspection is a tool available for assessment. It may not always be the case because of the legislative framework that is found in other jurisdictions.
Thank you, Paul. Professor Schruff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of KPMG International, I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me to this round table, and I'm happy to explain to you how we, KPMG, would approach this question. I think it is clear that KPMG, as all the other major audit firms, have always supported a strong and an effective independent oversight as an essential for public confidence in financial reporting as well as in the capital markets. And we do agree that one element of this is independent inspection of audit firms. Just to remind you that we live in a globalizing world, it has been said already, just briefly mentioning capital markets are globalized now. Companies are doing business globally, as well as auditing firms have established global networks. That's a matter of fact. Accounting standards are moving towards global, to become global. Auditing standards moving towards that. But oversight still is very, very much a national issue, and that's why we, KPMG International, would recommend that global regulatory convergence is the logical consequence in this environment, and we would very much welcome the PCAOB taking this initiative forward in order to achieve that. And we also, we as the audit firms, are also supporting and encouraging our national regulators, national oversight bodies to establish an inspection process that would meet to a large extent or even 100% the criteria of the PCAOB policy statement. So by doing this, and it has been said by other colleagues before, we're raising the quality of the oversight globally, not only in Europe but also in other jurisdictions. There should be, finally, an equally effective, independent and rigorous oversight system throughout the globe. That's our belief. Many countries, that's a matter of fact, have established already effective oversight systems or are in the process of establishing that, and many countries have had oversight systems long before the PCAOB has been created. They operated under different models, of course. Now they're changing towards the PCAOB model, and therefore I think we very much support the PCAOB adopting the principle or the idea of full reliance, because the world is moving closer together and global convergence is at least beginning. The question is how the PCAOB now should assess the rigor and independence of oversight bodies. We do not believe that full reliance should necessitate a first joint inspection. On the other hand, if the board believes that this is necessary from your perspective, we would not object to that. We have had experiences with joint inspections in the UK, as Paul George has mentioned, and in a number of other countries outside Europe. But in this context, I think we need to remember that joint inspections are a means to an end and not an end in itself. Once the PCAOB have used this joint inspection in order to assess the non-US oversight systems, then there should be finally fully reliance. That means that there will be an ongoing exchange of results, of findings, of course, but not a joint inspection anymore. As we have stated in our written comment letter, we do see alternative ways of getting there, of assessing the effectiveness of oversight mechanisms. And there is at least two alternatives. One would be the PCAOB acting as an observer rather than being part of the national oversight process and inspection process. It is not necessary in our view that in order to assess the effectiveness, the independence and the rigor of a non-US inspection system, that the PCAOB becomes part of it as a joint inspector alongside the national oversight. And that would also avoid a number of legal obstacles that have been mentioned early on. Another alternative would be cooperation. That would be the PCAOB, for example, sitting together with the oversight body of a non-US country, together when setting the inspection plans, and would also review the findings, the documents that will be created through the process of inspection by that national oversight body. I think in addition to that, it's worth mentioning that there has been and will be hopefully some training organized through IFIA or through the PCAOB itself, and participation in that training together with transparency of local oversight and local oversight processes in protocols also on the sharing of papers and methodology, that should give some comfort to the PCAOB of the robustness of the home country oversight process. And as I mentioned earlier, there should be an ongoing exchange of findings between the regulators, between the oversight bodies. You've asked for some parameters and about the timing. I think it is almost impossible to fix any minimum or maximum amount of time that be needed. Our experience was that these joint inspections did not take longer than about 2 weeks. That's just the experience. The key drivers for this assessment, which is needed, obviously, is first of all the knowledge that the PCAOB can get about the national oversight system, and the best way to get this knowledge is to just sit together and explain to each other, maybe ask questions, how the national system is established and is effectively working. And that would at least provide the PCAOB with sort of a pre-assessment or initial assessment, and based on that, and maybe also based on the number of SEC registrants audited by that non-US audit firm, would also influence the amount of time that's needed and the procedures that are appropriate to assess the effectiveness of that system. Just a remark in this context, it is not necessary, if the board wants to make an assessment of the effectiveness, it is not necessary to do inspections in each and every audit firm in that particular non-US country. So based on this, and to conclude with, we are very supportive of the idea moving forward, starting off with the idea of full reliance, but we would hopefully get to a situation where we finally reach the concept of home country control. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. We have a number of names up. We'll go to Jeff Mahoney, and then Jeff Wilming, Lynn, Barbara, and Pierre.
Thank you. Just two very brief comments. First, Mr. George, on the you're reading the comment letters. I generally agree with you on your interpretation of the letters. But what would have been helpful for me, and I think other investors, is if some of those letters would have set out in some detail which of the proposed essential criteria are currently being met and which are not. That would have been helpful. Second, you want to go ahead?
I think my understanding of the idea was to comment actually on the proposed policy statement. It wasn't to undertake the assessment itself. I mean, we stand ready to sit with the PCAOB board and go through exactly how we meet each and every one of the principles, and also go through each of the essential criteria and illustrate what we do in that regard. I see them as separate exercises.
Okay, that would be very helpful, and to kind of follow up what Lynn was saying, I think for investors to support this type of approach, they would have to know exactly where we stand, which of these are currently met, which aren't, which can be replaced with something equivalent. I don't think we have that information at this point, and so I think for investors to support this type of approach, it's very difficult to do without that information. The second comment I would make is, in my mind, the right to participate in a joint inspection, just the right to participate, whether it be the PCAOB or one of the other entities' right to participate here in a joint inspection, that seems to be a pretty basic right to me, and one that I think investors would be troubled if the PCAOB or other entities did not have that right. And so, again, if we're going to go down this road of the sliding approach with full reliance on one end, again, wouldn't we have some basic principles that we would require everyone to achieve to have full reliance at the top end of the scale? And why wouldn't one of those basic principles be the right to have a joint inspection, just the right to have a joint inspection? So I'd be interested in your response to that.
Actually, Jeff, what the two points I was going to make, I think maybe might be helpful. You'll be the judge of that. I see us, in the last hour or so, talking a bit in absolutes is the sense I get. Absolutes in a couple of respects, that a joint inspection is something called X, and full reliance is something called Y. and there's no gap, there's nothing in between. And if I move to Y, I'm losing something, you know, in X. I think also where that, you know, where that comes in, Jeff, is in terms of actually understanding the dynamics of what full reliance means. And we can debate, and I think we did before, if Pierre made the comment earlier, that the criteria actually is quite, you know, is quite high and strict. And the meaning of full reliance, and I think this is quoted from there, talks about that although the non-U.S. oversight entity will plan, carry out the work, and make findings, the board itself retains the ability to observe. An observation may involve a range of activities, and depending on facts and circumstances, and this, Barbara, is where this concept of being, you know, flexible in terms of the interpretation comes in, may vary by jurisdiction or inspection. And then there's some examples. So as we looked at full reliance versus joint inspections, it was a journey. And I would suggest two things we ought to think about, or what is the objective of that journey, and I like the way Paul put it. You know, if the objective is to assess, get to the point where you're taking a journey, you're going to assess, and in that process, bring everybody up to the standards we all want to achieve that I think we've agreed upon here. That is very different than sharing the workload in terms of the detailed stuff, which is how the joint inspections begin. And what we heard Paul just describe, and I talked to people in our outfit, and they would echo that description, is a migration that was very natural based upon the bilateral work, mutual respect, and sharing of work, you know, that occurred. So one point, I think, is it's a journey, but what is the objective? And the objective, I think, the proposal in here is to make an assessment. So it's not about losing those rights. The rights, in fact, are retained, as I would see it under this proposal. But you want to make the assessment as opposed to actually performing the detailed work. The second point I'd like to make is to go back to something Lynn said, because I couldn't agree more. This question of, to make the inspections robust, you know, from where the auditor sits, I share Lynn's experience. You know, I've you know, worked overseas on extended periods of time, and I learned very, very quickly that the last thing I would ever do as an American is think I could conduct, you know, an audit in any of the countries I've lived in. I've learned more about what I don't know in terms of the cultures and practices at the end of that. And so this concept of that home regulator providing that expertise is critical. Where it gets, when it gets a bit challenging is when we get into, well, what if I don't have the expertise, Barbara, to your point, for U.S. GAAP or U.S. laws? And that's where I think, at least from our perspective, we were arguing that these essential criteria be guidance. I'll give you one example. One of it reads specifically, the non-U.S. oversight systems inspection staff must have sufficient expertise, et cetera, built inside. Well, there may be a multitude of other ways to gather that expertise that regulators in discussions with each other, you know, could accomplish. In specific situations, you could get it through other respects. You could get it through participation. You could get it elsewhere if you determined, as a regulator, it's not our job to do that, that that would be important to meet the qualitative objectives of the inspection.
Well, actually, Lynn, you were next, so if you'd like to respond.
Someone agreed to me. I was pleased to hear that. One thing comes to mind as I listen to this conversation, though, is back to my experience as an audit partner. When we were auditing an international organization, we might very well rely upon other affiliates of the firm around the world. For example, when I chaired the audit committee at Sun, and E&Y did our audit. Randy's firm would be based there out of the U.S., but then they'd rely upon international affiliates. And notwithstanding their dependency reliance on the international affiliates, the engagement team did, in fact, visit and in some case participate in portions of those international audits. They were unwilling just to turn around and themselves say, we'll go to what I would consider to be full reliance as defined within the policy statement. Likewise, though, if an audit firm didn't have an affiliate in another country and therefore was going to it was going to be another firm performing the audit work in that foreign country, then you do even more work. You didn't ever just rely upon the status of that firm. You go over and you look through their procedures. You take a clear look at their independence. You'd look at their audit program, and you'd inspect audit work as well. You never just took it verbatim, and that was assuming if you did all that and you could get comfort, you wouldn't make reference to them, which is somewhat the position the PCAOB would be put in here, because they'd be taking responsibility for the final report. They have to under the federal legislation here. And in that scenario, there is no avenue for an auditor to go to a full reliance type operation. And I find it somewhat interesting that we're saying that the oversight bodies can do what the audit firms themselves can't do or wouldn't do in terms of the course of the performance of the audit, but yet we're looking for the inspection bodies to do something we wouldn't even expect the auditors, nor would the auditors be willing to do full reliance type thing. And I find that somewhat puzzling as to why you could get there as oversight bodies, but you can't get there as an auditor themselves. And that the auditors have written those standards.
In terms of the immediate question, and we'll just take as a given that we don't believe the board should proceed with a policy that is in violation of the intent of Sarbanes-Oxley or its own previous determination, then it's not in the public interest. But if it decides to do so, obviously we think that it should not enter into a full reliance agreement without having extensive experience of joint inspections. And in fact, we don't believe that negotiation for full reliance should begin until there's been extensive experience under joint inspections that would create the kind of trust that would make that assessment appropriate. As for some of the previous comments, Mr. George described to me what sounded like a really well-functioning joint inspection system, that as greater trust is developed, there's more reliance and on the kind of sliding scale that Rule 4012 initially anticipated, and you know that sounded pretty cooperative to me. On the issue of the essential criteria, the EU letter, comment letter, for example, suggests that under a principles-based approach to full reliance, that the Eighth Directive should be seen as equivalent to Sarbanes-Oxley. Now, I will admit, I have not read every word of the Eighth Directive, but I have read Mr. McCreevy's comments about it, and I have read the question and answer facts, whatever. And it seems to suggest that under this approach, professional associations could have extensive involvement in the inspections, and the oversight board would have to, you know, oversee the inspections. They couldn't just bless what the professional associations already had in place. Well, this is a very different standard for inspection than what Sarbanes-Oxley Act demands, and, you know, demands not just for U.S. firms, but for foreign firms. And so when we say that the letters argue for treating the essential criteria as not essential, this is the kind of comment we're talking about that asks us to rely on an approach that is exactly the approach that Sarbanes-Oxley was passed to counteract.
Okay. I want to be mindful of the time here, because the next three questions are actually very very important as well, and I think some of the comments may also be relevant to that, because the next question has to do with observation. And so we've heard some talk about observation and some comments already that, you know, joint inspections as an assessment tool isn't necessary. We could actually observe. And then, of course, in the comment letters themselves, we had a lot of comments about what exactly does observation mean, and and some suggestions as to how the board should observe. So let me just summarize, or not summarize, but quote from what the policy statement says. Observation may involve a range of activities, and depending on facts and circumstances, may vary by jurisdiction or inspection. For example, in some instances, PCOB inspectors may simply consult with the non-U.S. oversight entity about its inspection plans or discuss with the non-U.S. inspectors any complicated or material inspection findings relevant to U.S. public companies. Excuse me. In other cases, PCOB inspectors may request to accompany the non-U.S. inspection team to the audit firm for interviews with key firm personnel. Finally, there may be occasions when the PCOB would request that the non-U.S. oversight entity allow PCOB inspectors to review portions of the firm's audit work papers. So the question is, and here I want to turn to Damon from AFL-CIO first, and then to Stephen Mayor from the Netherlands. In your view, what form of observation is appropriate once the board has determined that full reliance is appropriate? So under the proposed policy statement, observation would come into play after it's been determined that full reliance is appropriate. And what relevant factors should the board consider when deciding the appropriate form of observation for a given non-U.S. oversight entity? In other words, what kinds of red flags would you want the board to consider? Damon?
I think that, I mean, the nature of this discussion, at least that part which I've been privileged to be part of, has ranged rather widely over the set of questions that interweave in this table, and I suspect that this one will not, this subsection will not be any different. And so, what I'm going to comment on is, I think, just the I want to make a couple of sort of framing comments and then address the question you actually posed to me. There are several large concerns floating around here that are quite distinct and have different levels of legitimacy. One is the issue of sort of inherently, should we have a global or multilateral regime here, or should we, or is there just inherent value in separate national schemes? Me personally, the labor movement I represent, we are in favor of strong global regulatory regimes in many areas, and this is not not an exception. And we don't have a particular interest in preserving some national uniqueness that we Americans or anyone else might imagine they have in some inherent way. The second, there's a second issue, which is an issue of sort of fairness, and I think that that issue arose in the context of the discussion of disclosure a few moments ago. And I think very legitimately a number of our guests here from other jurisdictions raised this point of, you know, come on now, right? You want to come to some understanding, and we can't get any information from you. I think an unforeseen consequence of certain aspects of the statute. There is an area where perhaps it would be fairly easy for people to come to a common place. Then there's the issue of sort of deep principles about what constitutes an adequate inspection and oversight regime. And I think the question that's been posed here is an effort to sidestep that, because I think the fundamental principled issue here, I think the issue which you hear over and over again from the investors around the table, is the issue of the independence of the overseer. It's really the core issue here. And I was pleased that Professor Schruff indicated that KPMG globally is quite supportive of independent oversight. I don't know how to operationalize that support, but it's the obstacle here. And so, in a way, my observation about observations, right, is that given, I think, what Lynn talked about really the complexity and detail of both the auditing process and then the process of inspecting audit firms, that no amount of after-the-fact observation can resolve a fundamental problem of lack of independence. Right? If fundamentally the regulators and the regulated are the same people, or if there is no obstacle to them going out and drinking in bars together after the inspection is over, before it starts, or during, if they draw their salaries from the same pots of money, how it would be conceivably possible for there to be some level of observation from a foreign country and likely in a foreign language to satisfy yourself that nothing really important got said in that barroom. It just strikes me as completely and utterly implausible. Now, I'll conclude by saying this, that I think if you could resolve that problem, everything else would probably fall into place rather neatly. And there would certainly be a great deal of goodwill toward resolving the remaining issues. And that the fundamental question around a global regime here is whether or not it will be a global regime built upon the principles that rescued the United States' capital markets in 2002, or the principles that nearly destroyed them. And for the investors around this table, there is simply no compromise on this. And I will finally add that we expect the government of the United States, whom our members elected, to stand up for this principle and to stand up without compromise.
Okay. Stephen, you were the next.
I will first briefly talk about, you know, what kind of would be the general framework for the situation once the reliance decision has been made, and what should be the kind of how do you work together as regulators. And clearly there will be exchange of information in that situation, and the question is what factors will drive this level of information. And finally, I will briefly comment on the practicalities of getting this accomplished. First, about the framework, as probably also clear from previous comments, I favor home country control. I think it's efficient and it is effective. And even in that system, you would have a substantial amount of information exchanged. How do you exactly arrange that? I think it's difficult to be very precise in advance about that. How international cooperation and regulation will work in the years to come is difficult to predict. And I think in that sense, it should be a principle-based framework. And I think what is currently in the rule is sufficiently principle-based and allows a range of methods of exchanging information in that sense, or proposal for different levels of observation. However, the fundamental principle should be is that, and this point was made by Paul George, it is about observing whether the system works, observing whether the regulatory body works, and not about taking a share of the work. And so in that sense, it's making yourself comfortable, getting assurance is that the regulator you rely upon is that it's competent and protects the public interest. Regarding the information exchange, one kind of first principle or situation would be is that once the regulator has been assessed in terms of its quality and how it works, including observations, clearly including these observations, I think you would like to have the right to be informed when there are changes at this regulatory body. So if there's a kind of a major change in the way the inspections work at the regulatory body, you would like to be informed about these changes, and this is also typically stipulated in MOUs about, you know, that of regulators that work together, that if there is a major impact or a major change in how the inspections are conducted, is that you as a regulator inform the other regulator is that you have changed your way of doing your inspections or your regulatory work, and so the regulator can again assess whether it's been the right decision to rely upon that regulator. In addition to these changes in the way the inspections are conducted, I can also imagine that in some cases there's a specific interest for another regulator to get more information on specific inspection reports. For example, if there would be a Dutch company which increases in terms of its size of its investor base in the US, for example, it goes to 80%, 90%, you would like to have probably additional assurance to what extent is how was this inspection done on this client, on this audit firm and its client, and what were the results. And I can also imagine that for certain specific issues, you would like to have extra information. For example, if there is an accounting issue that attracts certain attention in a specific market, you can imagine that the regulator would like to have additional information on that issue and in additional detail on the inspections conducted on that issue. However, the basic principle should still be is that it's to assess the quality of the work done and not taking part of the work for itself. How will this work practically? Typically, this is arranged in MOUs. We have done that before. It's a very common form between regulators. And in that sense, there are examples in the securities regulation area how you can accomplish this.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. I believe we have Randy and then Jeff and then Pierre.
Thank you, Ron. I want to touch on observation, but I actually want to go back to Lynn's comment right at the end on joint inspections, because there's been far too many people agreeing with Lynn today. So I'd like to break that trend. I think the analogy is a good one, Lynn, in terms of what an auditor does. You mentioned an audit engagement conducted by Ernst & Young and team being unwilling to rely on the work done by an affiliate. I mean, visiting another affiliate and visiting with auditors is kind of a common way of doing an assessment on the competence of those people and the scope of the work. And so I think it's part of the process. And as you correctly said, you have instances where the team will go beyond that and look at more work papers and do more work. I think that's very similar to what's being described here as being something rather than being something very different. I think the issue is whether a joint inspection is kind of the minimum and you go beyond that if you think you need to do more work, or whether particularly once you reach the stage along the curve of closer to full reliance, whether that's no longer the minimum. It's still in the toolkit, but frankly, observation or some other way of getting comfort is maybe okay. And so I don't disagree with the analogy, but I guess I wouldn't think I leave the analogy being, for us, a joint inspection is the baseline, the minimum, and then you go beyond that. I think the comparison is, no, once you get closer to full reliance, things short of a joint inspection you would think would be the norm and not the exception.
I guess, is it your, Jeff, or is that Lynn's? It's Lynn's. Lynn, your name tag is up. Did you want to say something?
Sure.
Why not? One, I'd just like to strongly support what Damon said earlier about the basic fundamental principles, and I think he outlined those in his comment letter very well, including the issue of the independence. I'd also like to make the point, again reiterate and support the point that Barb made, dealing with the issue of equivalency, having dealt with an inspection process where you had professionals involved with the inspection process versus one where you don't. I don't view those as equivalent. I don't even think they're remotely equivalent in one way or the other, and certainly wouldn't meet any equivalency type test whatsoever. And I think when you bring members of the profession, active members of the profession, not a Dan Gelser or Charlie Niemeyer who's been out of it for a while, but when you bring active members of the profession into the process, I don't see how you can any longer turn around and say that meets the fundamental principle of independence. And so I don't see that as being equivalent. Someone mentioned that the fact that we do mutual cooperation amongst the banking regulators. I don't know that in light of the subprime debacle that's happened not only in the U.S. but all around the globe, that I'd use the banking model as a model that I'd want to hold up to any investor group. It's cost my fund $4 billion in just the last half dozen months or so. So it's certainly not something that I'd say is something we should all turn around and strive for.
Oops, excuse me. Thank you, Lynn. Pierre?
Again, I'm going to disagree with Lynn on this last comment. Not about the subprime, because on subprime, many things could be said, but I'm not going to tell them now. But anyway, but on the fact, I mean, we are reinventing the wheel in the audit sector. I mean, all these discussions have already taken place in the field of securities, in the field of banking, in the field of insurance. All these issues have been discussed and solved. I've learned today that PCOB is a toddler and the rest of the world is babies in the field of auditing. But maybe we should learn from the grown-up persons and to look what they've done and not done and try to improve the system based on that. And again, let's not necessarily try to find new solutions and let's see what has been done and again, maybe improve on some aspects if we agree with them. Second element, with respect to the joint inspection and the observers and so on. Again, we are talking about different phases. I mean, the idea is basically, if you rely on someone, it's basically that you trust this person. It's not something that you have done without checking first if this person meets certain criteria or this body meets certain criteria. If this person meets this criteria, basically the whole idea of reliance is to accept this person. Again, the question of home country control is something which exists everywhere for many sectors. Why would it be different for the field of auditing? Now, trusting someone is of course very good, but you need to have some insurance. And we all agree with that. We all agree that you need to have some kind of mechanism to make sure that your confidence is well placed. And of course, that's why observership and the possibility of having observers is important. But again, observers should play a role, but should not be the same as joint inspection. So if it's the same as joint inspections, why do we have full reliance? And if I can take just a small note, I mean, sending joint inspectors probably good for the airlines, which need money in the oil crisis. But I'm not sure it's necessarily good for a more general point of view. I mean, that's not necessarily the way to cooperate in the world today. Finally, last comment, but we will come back to that. I fully agree with Damon. Independence is fundamental. And that's the key issue of everything. And to make sure that you have independent public oversight bodies composed of independent persons, I fully agree with you. But I know we'll come back to this issue on the next question. But we all agree on that. That's the key to everything. If you don't have this independence from the public oversight body, I agree, the rest will be spoiled, will not function. If you have this independence, things will function at the end of the day.
All right, thank you, Pierre. You're right. The next question is about independence, but let me turn to Peter before we come back to everyone's favorite topic.
Well, in a sense, I'm sorry, I'm getting on to the next question. Pierre said most of what I was going to say, so just very briefly, Damon, I was going to agree with everything that you said, and independence is fundamental. And the comment letter, certainly that my firm put in, and I just looked very quickly at the European Commission's comment letter, is not for 1 minute suggesting otherwise. What it's saying is that in different countries, different mechanisms have been put in place, and there needs to be a proper assessment by the PCOB whether this has impaired independence or not. And a rules-based approach might get us into some difficulty here. That was the only comment. Otherwise, yeah, we are all full square. Independence of both oversight and inspection process is essential.
Great. Thank you, Peter. All right, let us move to the third question of this discussion session. As I mentioned, it does relate to the independence and specifically the independence of the governing body. There are some other criteria in the proposed policy statement that relate to the independence of other components, namely the inspectors, the funding, and so forth, but this question really focuses on the independence of the governing body. Let me remind you what the proposed policy statement says under Principle 2, which is the independence of the 9 U.S. system. The first criteria under this principle requires that, quote, the majority of the governing body of the 9 U.S. oversight entity must be comprised of persons who are not current or former accountants or auditors or affiliated with an audit firm or the audit profession, unquote. Thus, while this essential criteria would permit a minority of the governing body to include current or former auditors or accountants would not qualify as independent to serve in the majority. With regard to the PCOB board's composition, Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as you all know, requires 2 of the 5 PCOB board members to be or have been certified public accountants. There is a 5-year cooling off period if one of those 2 members is the chair. The Act also prohibits the board members from having any other employment. So the question that we've raised, and I've asked Jeff Mahoney to respond first, and then we'll turn to Randy Fletchall from Ernst & Young, is do you agree with this criterion's definition of independence for the governing body? Why or why not?
Thank you, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to participate at this important roundtable.
The Council of Institutional Investors applauds the PCOB's ongoing efforts under Rule 4012 to closely coordinate its required inspections of PCOB-registered non-U.S. audit firms with the audit oversight entities and regulators in countries in which those firms are located. I think we can all agree that such coordination efforts are an appropriate and necessary response to this ever-increasing global capital market system and a practical and cost-effective way, as a number of you have mentioned, of fulfilling the PCOB's statutory responsibilities to U.S. investors and other market participants under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Coordination with foreign counterparts, however, should always be viewed, I believe, and many investors believe, as an opportunity to improve audited financial reports here in the U.S. and abroad. And in that regard, if the PCOB decides to continue to pursue this full reliance approach described in the proposed statement, the board should make every effort, in my mind, to preserve and, if possible, to enhance those basic principles and related criteria that were fundamental to the creation of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, and that I believe, and most investors, many investors here in the U.S. believe, are fundamental to protecting investors going forward. And as some of you have already commented, I believe, and many investors believe, council members believe, that the most important of those basic principles is this principle of independence. I think the history of the U.S. auditing profession's troubles that we've had, as recounted in the events leading to Sarbanes-Oxley and the hearings that were held by Senator Sarbanes and others, in the legislative history of the Act, I think it all makes clear that the successful operation of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and its ability to enhance the quality of audited financial statements is highly, highly dependent on the PCOB's independence now and going forward. And as a result, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act includes several requirements that were intended to ensure this ongoing independence and objectivity of the PCOB. And those requirements include, and I think most importantly, one, that each member of the PCOB shall serve on a full-time basis, full-time board members. They cannot be employed by any other person or engage in any other professional business activity. And then the second one that I think is very important is that the PCOB has a guaranteed, secure source of funding that's not dependent on the voluntary contributions from the auditing profession or from the audit clients that have a stake in the outcome of the board's activities. In my opinion, it would be clearly inconsistent with the language and intent of Sarbanes-Oxley, and it would be clearly inconsistent with the needs and demands of U.S. investors for the PCOB to grant full reliance status to an oversight entity that fails to meet this basic principle of independence and the essential criterion of independence that I just referred to. The independence PCOB is absolutely critical in my mind to improving the quality of audited financial reports here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And it's at the very core, as someone has earlier said, it's at the very core of the PCOB's statutorily mandated mission to protect investors and serve the public interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Randy?
Thank you, Rhonda. I said earlier today at lunchtime, I said, what time is tip-off? 1:30. I think it was more like 4:15. I think we're finally the question that everyone has been waiting for and some people have commented on along the way. I think Lynn mentioned about an hour ago the two key criteria for a board member of an audit oversight body being independence and knowledge or qualifications, and I couldn't agree more with those. I look at the formation of the PCOB itself, and I know our firm, and I think I can speak not just for my firm, but for others, I think we embraced the PCOB having an independent and qualified regulator because it brings credibility to the oversight and regulation, and frankly, that breeds trust and confidence in the audit profession, which is what this is all about. My simple mind, I need to break this down in just two components. One, kind of what's required or permitted for a majority of the board members or members of the governing body, and then what's not permitted, say, for a minority. For the majority, it talks about a restriction on former or past auditors or accountants or a person who's associated with an audit firm or associated with the audit profession. I would be careful with that list, I guess, because I think the real issue is association with an audit firm. There are many licensed accountants who never practice public company auditing. and I don't know why you would disqualify them from being in the majority. There are many who pass through, unfortunately, for short periods of time, a public company auditing firm, but it might have been years ago, and it might have been a very brief part of their career. You read studies now about the younger generation and how many jobs and careers they're going to have during their lifetime as opposed to one or two. And so I think we ought to take a look at, you know, do we necessarily automatically want to exclude accountants who never practice in public accounting, or those who do just for some short period of time? And I guess I would go even further and say I don't know why you would automatically disqualify those who practice in public accounting after some appropriate cooling off period to decide that they would be qualified to do that. So that's what I think about the majority. I guess in the minority, I certainly understand why at the time of the formation of the PCOB, you know, there was no thought given to allowing current practitioners to be on the PCOB. But my understanding is, I guess, around the world, it might be different. There may be some situations now where a current practitioner is a part of that process. And all I would say, I guess, is if it's the right person, you got to start with that, and you have the right protocols for recusal and conflicts of interest and the right policies and procedures, I just wouldn't say in all cases you automatically jump to that's bad, that's evil, that's an impairment of independence for the full board when you're only talking about a minority, and that automatically that would preclude an ability to place any reliance on that board. That's all.
Thank you, Randy. Stephen Meyer from the Netherlands.
Just a brief comment on this issue. I fully agree that independence is very important. I cannot see a situation where the board members wouldn't be full-time, so there is the requirement of full-time board members. And it should also be clear that in no way it should reflect the older situation of any, you know, kind of a peer review system, or where auditors that are, you know, still involved in practice would be part of kind of the, you know, the current infrastructure of the regulatory body. In our specific case, we sometimes consult with practicing auditors, but this is about very specific technical cases where you simply need the knowledge of a, you know, on a specific issue. So that would be, but that would be on a kind of a, you know, one specific issue. You would consult with that auditor and subsequently would make your own assessment. So I cannot see a situation where auditors that work in practice are kind of, you know, part of the infrastructure of the regulatory body.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Paul, George?
Thank you. I really just wanted to perhaps support one of the comments that Randy mentioned in terms of the definition of who would not qualify as being independent. In the UK, we have a particular situation in that vast numbers of highly financially literate graduates seek to go into the accounting profession for a three-year training period to become accountants. They don't necessarily seek to become auditors. And perhaps like the MBA in many other jurisdictions, that's seen as a career ticket into many successful positions and senior appointments in business and commerce. And I think to exclude perhaps somebody who spent their formative years gaining an accounting qualification as opposed to being a statutory auditor, signing audit reports, I think are two quite different things. And I think the way the definition is worded at the moment has some dangers in that, for example, it would be quite possible to be the senior partner of one of the accounting firms and not be a qualified accountant. They could be a tax professional, for example, or a management consultant by previous training. That person, when they retired, would not necessarily be breached the independence test, whereas perhaps if the same person or perhaps if somebody else had spent their first 3 years and then had 35 years of a successful career elsewhere, they would breach the independence rules. And I think we just need to be careful there. Independence is fundamental to the success of this system, and we wholeheartedly support that. We just need to make sure that we get the definition right, or at least in applying the essential criteria beneath that, that we have sensible judgments.
Damon, I think you were next.
First, a number of people at various times in this discussion have talked about the relative place of internationalization in audit regulation versus other areas of the capital markets. I think it's been in some ways mischaracterized. This provision goes well beyond anything. This provision, in the form it's being proposed, I believe goes well beyond anything that we currently have in the area of securities regulation. I mean, obviously, IOSCO has made great strides in international cooperation, but I don't think there's nothing like this present in the area of securities regulation. There are certainly ideas about this sort of thing in the area of the financial accounting rules, that there's certainly directionality to some of what people are saying, but this is, in fact, in a tangible form, among the most aggressive specific proposals that is on the table in the global environment. I'm not saying that if you get it right, that's not necessarily a terrible thing, but we ought not to misunderstand where exactly we fit on the continuum here. With respect to the discussion about independence, I think this has been extraordinarily valuable because I think we've heard two really distinct kinds of comments, which should educate the board, the PCAOB, and the press and the public as to what exactly is going on here. On the first hand, we've had several, I think, quite thoughtful comments from our non-U.S. colleagues here today about some of the detailed complexities involved in actually making this kind of arrangement work. I think Paul's comment really, I thought, was exactly in that vein. And it goes to the point I made earlier today that this is actually complicated. Doing this right is complicated. It needs to be done in a very deliberate fashion, with an eye toward first principles and with an eye toward all the various details that are going to play into it. But there's another agenda on the table. There's another agenda on the table that's quite different. And I'm very fond of Randy, and I thank him for making it very clear what that agenda is. And the agenda is to reopen the fundamental judgments that were made in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act by the Congress of the United States and signed into law by the President of the United States. And that question is whether or not people who are actively in the business of auditing public companies get to decide whether that job is being done right by their friends. That question, the audit firms would like to reopen. I understand why they'd like to reopen it. Perhaps I would if I was in their place. It's not an investor's interest. It's not in the public interest. And if it's going to be reopened, it needs to be reopened at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, where the capital of the United States is.
Thank you, Damon. Lynn, you were next. Did I get it wrong? Okay, we'll come.
Go ahead, Pierre. No, I went first last time. You go first this time. Go ahead. Okay. You're a gentleman.
Well, Pierre, you were waving your hand around, so why don't you go first?
Thanks. I'm tickled pink to hear you listen to investors. This is good. The fundamental issue that Randy teed up, of someone being a practicing accountant being involved in the process, my experience in the past has been, again, it just doesn't work. It is very clear that when we had that system here in the U.S., it was a system of don't tell on me, if I won't tell on you. And it's the way the system worked, and it's the way you should expect the system to work, because at that point in time, you're asking that person to serve two masters, the auditing firm that they're working for and paying them and they're depending upon for their livelihood, as well as serving in an oversight role investors. And it's you're asking them to carry two buckets of water that they just can't carry. It just doesn't happen. I remember at my former firm, we had, for example, a member of the firm who was at a very senior position at the Auditing Standards Board, and in the national office, we all talked about whether or not a position should be taken, and he favored a position that was very much so in support of investors. And he voted against the firm on it, and that guy lost his role as one of the very senior partners in the national office and was moved out of the firm. And that sent a chilling message to the rest of the people in the national office as to when those type of questions came up, which side you better be on. And as an SEC chief accountant, we saw that also in the inspections from time to time. You didn't see the rigorous in-depth. I remember one of the last inspections done of one of the firms by another one of the firms just shortly before the Enron matter. And they came back, and as we were doing the exit conference, we asked, were there any particular questions or issues? And they said, in fact, there was, that documentation they found was often missing. And so I said, well, what do you mean by documentation often missing? How often? And they said, in about 50% of the engagements. And I said, okay. So what'd you do? You inspected these audits, and half of them were missing adequate documentation. What did you do to go resolve the issues to where the work really got done? Because that's what we want to find out, is the work really got done. And I think the EU raised that issue in their comment letter. And his response was, well, I went back to the people who did the work and asked them if they'd done the work. You know, that's not a rigorous inspection process. Yet that is how we've seen the firms operate, and that's what gave us the trauma that almost brought down the U.S. capital markets, and unfortunately, many of the other markets around the world with it. It's a system that doesn't work. And to use Randy's words, what did you say, bad, evil, and something else, Randy? I think when you bring those firms in or those individuals out of the profession in and put them in that role of inspecting one another, it is a bad, evil, and whatever else it was he said about it. It just doesn't work because people can't serve two masters, and with one of those masters being the profession who they're working for and one of them being investors. And in this scenario, if you're going to adequately protect investors, which is what the objective has been said in many of the letters, then it's got to be a sole focus on the investor side, and that means they need to be full-time employees of whatever that oversight is. And if one of the other troubling comments is in some of the letters say, well, if the oversight body doesn't have enough expertise, then may we go back to the profession. Well, if the oversight body doesn't have enough expertise to do the inspections, that's something fairly strong about that oversight body in and of itself. It doesn't have enough resources to go get the type of people knowledgeable to do the job and do it right. And that's not a body that you can in any way, fashion, shape, or form from an investor perspective get confidence in as being reliable.
Pierre.
Thanks, Rhonda. I have the feeling that this is an area in which we have really an agreement, at least in Europe and I believe in the States, and I'm sure the firms will agree with it. Independence is fundamental. Independence is fundamental for the composition of the public oversight board, meaning that the members of the public oversight bodies should be independent from the audit profession, at least the majority of them. Funding should be also independent from the public profession, and inspection should be done by public, with public authorities being heavily involved in that. We all agree on that, and I believe there is a consensus, and we don't want to reopen this consensus. And that's good, because I fully agree with you. That's the only way we can achieve what we want to achieve. You cannot, if you say serve two masters, you cannot be efficient. You need to serve only one master, which is a public one, and you need to defend investor protection. Just a small point which was raised by Paul and Son, the definition, the present definition of independence does not take into account a cooling off period. So basically, you have been an accountant once in your life, you are an accountant forever, which is good probably, but that's not necessarily what you apply yourself or your chairman, because for your chairman of the PCOB, if he or she, by the way, was an accountant, I'm not, don't take it personally, you have a cooling off period of 5 years. Just so basically the idea is that we should have maybe some kind of cooling off period to assess this criteria. But that's a technical issue, it's not something fundamental. On the principle itself of independence, there is a consensus. And I believe that's fundamental.
Great. Thank you, Pierre. Randy, you were next.
us having started this, I would like to respond to both Damon and Lynn. And Damon, I mean, we are in far more violent agreement than I think your comments reflected about my comments. I am very serious about how much the independence and qualifications of the PCB means to us in terms of giving us the trust and confidence we want from the public. Again, I would not compare the old firm-on-firm peer review with a POB oversight as anywhere close to what I'm suggesting might be, again, acceptable in some locations at, you know, some time. I don't think, you know, again, the minority being current practitioners, it would necessarily, in all cases, depending on the market, depending on the number of issuers, be the end of the world. But I go back, I'm much more interested in, I think, my first comments on the majority of the board, and that is I would hate to see us exclude people who, because at some time, and they were accountants or auditors long ago, that we automatically exclude them, because I think in some markets it's very important to draw them. I do, Lynn, I would disagree a little bit on the inspection piece. I don't think that drawing on current practitioners for their expertise is necessarily wrong or bad in some places where it is a struggle to get enough people. If you can't do that, then that may be a case where the PCB says we can't give reliance and we have to step in. So I don't think, Damon, I will guarantee you, Damon, as I think there is no agenda here, hidden or otherwise, that says we want to overturn Sarbanes-Oxley. So please, please don't ascribe that to me.
Professor Schroff.
Sorry, thank you. I would just add to that what Randy said. It's obviously not the case that the audit firms would like to reopen this debate. As I clearly said, we are interested in an oversight mechanism that has the respect of the public, because it is essential that the public trusts into what we are doing. That's the basis for our work. So independence, of course, is essential to that. But then the question is, how should the oversight bodies get the necessary expertise? And it is a little bit like what Lynn Turner said: the less you've been involved in the profession, the better in terms of independence. But where should people get the knowledge? It is essential that we have people in the oversight process to some extent, that they can really judge what they see and what they find against the standards. Therefore, I very much agree with what Pierre said. We need a cooling off period, but that should not be longer, definitely not be longer than 5 years, because in 5 years the world is changing so much, and it is the experience is losing weight, and therefore I think 5 years is a maximum. But after that, people should be cooled off and be independent enough to exercise this.
Okay, I'm going to go to Paul and then Damon and then Barbara, and I just ask you to be brief so that we can move to the last question.
I just wanted to pick up one point that Lynn made about full-time board members. I think that the scale of the PCAB's operations lend themselves to having five full-time board members. Many other jurisdictions do not have the same scale of capital market or number of audit firms auditing such entities, and therefore I think it's not necessarily appropriate to have a full-time board commitment, and therefore there are other governance arrangements which can achieve the same end.
Thank you. Damon?
I think it's extremely important at this point in the conversation to be very precise as to what, at least I think, the investors participating in this dialogue mean when we say independence, because it appears that, like many things in America, motherhood and apple pie, everyone's for independence. But we need to be clear what we're talking about. I think these are the issues. And remember, we're talking about this in the context of the conception of a full reliance regime. It may be that there are many places in this world where these standards cannot be met, and that may not reflect poorly on their morals or their character, but it may reflect on whether or not we can rely on them fully in the context of our capital markets. The issues here are this. One, and ineffectively, I'm reading off of the statute book, which is a point I want to continue to make here, that there are obligations that the board has that are hardwired here. And what they are, one, right, that the majority of the body should be independent, that the majority of the body should be non-accountants, non-people not in the profession itself. It's a fundamental principle of the way in which this system is structured in the United States. Secondly, that none of the participants in the body, none, zero, be employees or otherwise have a substantial economic stake in the employees, partners, participants, or otherwise have a substantial economic stake in the firms being overseen. And the corollary to that, in general, is that the board be full-time. Right? Those concepts are intertwined. Now, I think it's true that one could imagine a circumstance in which the board might not be full-time if the nature of what they were doing was sufficiently detached from what they were reviewing. Right? And I think this goes to the notion that the world's complicated, and you might want to have a certain amount of subtlety in the way this would be approached, which goes to the point that this is going to take longer than we're allotting to this today. That's independence. That's what it means in our minds. And if we're talking about other things, like having, just a majority and having some people from some of the firms participate and some people close their eyes and hold their ears and this kind of thing, that's not independence.
Barbara, you're going to have the last word on this question.
And I am going to be quick. I think we're confusing two concepts here. I don't think the fact that someone was once an auditor or an accountant makes them not independent. I don't think Charlie's not independent. I don't think Dan's not independent. The notion of having, there you are, the notion of having a majority of non-accountants on the board in Sarbanes-Oxley Act context was that you didn't want a board to become so embedded in an industry way of thinking that they lost their broader view of the world. The other thing that's in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, of course, is they have to have a demonstrated record of public service. I mean, I think there's an ability to look at this whole cooling off period concept. I'd be happy with a board of all accountants if I get to name them. Lynn, you ready? I mean, just it's not the fact that someone is a former auditor that makes them not independent. The whole board needs to be independent. Some of them can be auditors. I'm very uncomfortable with the notion of practicing auditors being on the board, but that's just, I think there are two different concepts here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the last question, and we only have, about 15 minutes because we're under a very strict time restraint here with the Army-Navy Club at 5 o'clock. So, quickly, the last question relates to the publication of inspection reports on individual inspections. And under this criteria, there is an option. The option is that either the non-U.S. oversight entity must issue public inspection reports on individual firms or agree not to object to the PCOB issuing such reports based on information from the non-U.S. oversight entity's inspections. Again, this would be in a full reliance context. The criterion goes on to describe the minimum conduct of the public report if the non-U.S. oversight entity issues it. And that if they do choose to take that option, the PCOB would then publish a reference to the non-U.S. entity's public report for each firm's inspections. And I'm going to turn to Mike first and then Pierre from the European Commission. The questions, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this proposed criterion, and how, if at all, in your view, should it be changed?
Thank you, Rhonda. I'll cover the advantages, disadvantages, and then I'll speak to some alternatives. With respect to the advantages, there are two advantages that are probably most commonly mentioned. In the U.S., the publication of individual inspection reports gives investors a direct view of the inspection process. And these reports can provide evidence as to how the regulators oversee the firms and how the firms function. So that's the first advantage. The second advantage is that is the deterrent value. In other words, a firm will be motivated to maintain high standards because they don't want a report published that has a negative finding. The disadvantages, and I think there are several actually, publication of individual inspection reports by themselves are not necessarily determinative with respect to the effectiveness of a national oversight system. There are some countries that prohibit the publication of individual inspection reports. They may have alternative means that still provide transparency. In other words, they may have a requirement for disclosure of negative results or sanctions. In addition, another disadvantage is that when you're in a country that has a small number of foreign private issuers, an individual inspection report could give disclosure about the foreign private issuer that may not be appropriate. And then lastly, we, Grant Thornton, support the issuance of individual inspection reports. But that's where they're appropriate and where they're balanced. So another disadvantage in jurisdictions where they've not previously had individual inspection reports, if the reports aren't balanced, if they only report the negative findings and don't provide appropriate context or explanation of those negative findings, it can have an unintended negative impact in the marketplace. If you look at alternatives, I think you have to go back to the principle and focus on the principle. And the principle is that the foreign oversight entity system should be transparent. And there are other ways that you can ensure transparency without publishing individual inspection reports. As I said earlier, the foreign entity can take other specific actions where they either issue a public warning or impose a penalty. Another alternative is to the principle of to promote the principle of transparency, maybe to have persons involved in the governance of the oversight system be selected in accordance with independent and transparent nominating procedures. Finally, just let me end by saying that there are no specific ways in which the criterion can be changed. I would urge the board to take a principles-based approach and really focus on the principle and not the just the inspection report itself.
Thank you, Mike. Pierre?
Thanks, Linda. Actually, I will not disagree with Mike. I will actually fully agree with him. Because, again, that's a very good example of what do we want to achieve and then how do we achieve what we want to achieve. And that's exactly the kind of issue. What do we want to achieve here? Basically, by this rule, by transparency, we want to make sure that, first of all, when there is a deficiency in the systems, in the internal control systems of a firm, this is known to the public, to protect the investors, if it's not remedied within a certain period of time. That's the objective. Why is it there? For very good reasons, again, to protect investors. We agree with this. We don't have any problem with this approach. And that, I'm sure that everybody in this room will agree with this approach. Now the question is, how do we do it? And the PCOB has devised a way to do it, which is suitable for the U.S. market, taking into account the specificities of the U.S. market. But does it mean that no other possibility to get the same information should not be allowed anywhere elsewhere in the world? taking into account the specificities of this market. Does it mean that a different approach would be less efficient than the US approach? No. It's simply different. But it reaches the same result. I would agree with you that if we don't agree, if we don't reach the same result, if we don't obtain the same information, then you have a problem, we have a problem, because then there is not equivalence. But so the debate here is basically, how do you get this information? But more important, do you get the same level of information? And I can tell you from a European point of view, we give the same level of information to investors that you get in Europe, maybe with slightly different needs, because for instance, we force audit firms audit firms to publish what we call a transparency report, which is not foreseen in the US. So it's a different approach. Is it better? Is it worse? I don't know. It's different simply. But it gets the same result, giving the information to the investors. And so from again, on this issue, like on many other issues, we agree on the objective. And the real question that you have to address to yourself, what is more important? To agree on the objectives, or to agree on the detailed methods to reach the same objective? And if you look, of course, at the detailed method to reach the objective, you might see differences. But it's like a half empty or half full glass. What is important, finally, is that you drink the same quantity of water, or anything else if you want to drink something else. But basically, at the end of the day, what matters is basically you get the same thing. And that's what we consider. So to come back to your concrete questions, we provide the same information, exactly the same level of information, maybe in a slightly different manner, but we provide the same level of information, and that's what should matter from a full reliance system.
Yunichi?
Just quickly to add to the Pierre's comment. For example, our system is like that way. US system is to publicize the part one of the inspection report first, and not to publicize the part two of the information. But if the audit firm is not improving or whatever, then that the 12 months after, later on, you are going to publicize it. So using this kind of publication as a leverage to move the audit company forward to the better direction, that's what I think. But our system is different. So our system is that the inspection report is very in-depth, and it might contain that very sensitive information, so that we don't publicize that information, because that the audit firm agrees that we agree. So the thing is that's fine. So that just don't take it granted that all other countries are like Americans. As usual. Okay. We have our different approach. So that the result is like that. So that if we provide the information or inspection report contents to the United States, PCAOB, then that the PCAOB automatically publicizes it, then that might cause a problem. So, you have already addressed it, that in the December the 5th document, that the PCAOB will consult with the non-US oversight entity about the contents of such report, which is a very good point. So it's absolutely necessary before you publicize that in this territory that we don't object to your attitude or your approach. That's fine. That's perfectly right. But because we might have some problem because of automatically that quote, Japanese CPAOB is stating unquote, that might cause serious problem in our territory. So please consult with us very closely and fundamentally please before you publicize it. That's the kind of thing that's definitely necessary.
Hey, Barbara, you were next. This has nothing to do with the relative merits of different ways that people do things. Sarbanes-Oxley Act requires not just that the PCAOB publish its inspection report, but that it reach its findings based on the inspection that it's conducted and publishes a report. I don't know how you do that under a full reliance approach, because I don't know how you reach findings based on an inspection you didn't conduct. And this is one of a number of areas where I think this proposal runs afoul of U.S. law.
So it doesn't apply to the Japanese territory, don't forget.
Lynn, you have your card up.
It would apply to Japanese companies listing in the U.S., though. The U.S. system is not always optimal, and I don't think should always be looked to as the optimal solution, and this is actually one of the areas. In fact, when the legislation was being drafted, there was a version coming out of the U.S. House of Representatives, sponsored by Michael Oxley at the time, and it had a much better transparency provision in that it required the reports on the audit firms be made publicly available right off immediately once the inspections were done, which was very similar to the POB peer review process, which was, quite frankly, that perspective part of it was even better than what we have. It was only after heavy lobbying of the profession of Senator Graham and Enzi that we ended up with the constraining language that provides some of the constraints that caused the concerns that Mike asked or talked about. So to that point, the auditors kind of got what they asked for, unfortunately, because it's not serving us as auditors. As an audit committee chair, though, I do want to be able to see those reports, and as investors, I want that information available, because as we vote on whether or not to ratify auditors, we need to know whether or not we want to make an informed decision, and we need information to do that. You need information along the lines of what's in the EU 8th directive. We think we need, other people think, and as the Treasury recommendations have said, and as they do in the UK, it needs to go further in that. But that information should be available and available to audit committees and investors so they can make informed decisions when they're voting on whether or not to ratify auditors. And I think as one of the well-known U.S. senators here in the U.S. Has said in the past, Senator Moynihan, secrecy is for losers. And we just need to get to where these reports are transparent, that they provide information that's of use to auditors and audit committees and investors and are not just an aggregated report that turns out to be meaningless because you can't get the information you need out of it.
Okay, well, we are about 1 minute away from 5 o'clock, so Pierre, if you have a very brief comment, I can call on you.
It was just simply to thank you for organizing this, but I will stop here.
Okay.
And being so transparent with us.
Let me thank everybody also. This is exactly the kind of exchange we expected to have today, full and frank, and I think it has been beneficial. I think anybody that cares to speak after 5 o'clock also volunteers to be assessed membership by the Army Navy Club. So I think we need to get out of here so that we don't get hit by this. Thank you all very much for the preparation that went into this, and thank you, Rhonda. This was exceptionally well done, well managed, well prepared, and your team.
Thank you all.